This is Windows Observer Launch Control. We are just seconds away from the start of the Observe Tech podcast. Stand by for final sequencing and launch. In 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And we have launch of the Observe Tech podcast. Keeping an eye on Windows and other things tech, here is your host, Richard Hay of WindowsObserver.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 86 of the Observe Tech Podcast. I'm your host, Rich Hay from WindowsObserver.com. Back with you once again. Today is the 11th of April, 2013. Episode 86, want to remind everybody that we are a very proud member of the Tech Podcast Network, techpodcast.com. Check them out. There's all kinds of great family-friendly shows there focused on tech and things like that. So please check out techpodcast.com. Want to mention a new partnership of Ascents that came about this week. Excuse me. I have always shared content with a site called PC Tech Talk. It's part of the PC Pit Stop Network. And this past week, we have agreed that each week I'm going to feature my podcast over there. So whatever episode of the show comes out on Thursday, beginning of next week, will be featured over at PC Tech Talk. So I hope that may be an avenue for a lot of folks to be able to hear the show and connect with us. So my thanks to the folks over at PC Pit Stop and PC Tech Talk for doing that for the podcast. I will include a link to PC Tech Talk in the show notes just so you have that. Now, last week we did try something a little different with episode 85, and we got a tremendous amount of feedback on it, and it was great to have, and we appreciate that very much, because the way the show was formatted, it was about 45 minutes or so of rapid-fire headlines, comments, and then moving on. And then last week I trimmed down the number of items I had to talk about, and I spent a little more time talking about them, slowed the pace down a bit, and I've had a tremendous amount of feedback on that change, and it overwhelmingly was positive. So we're going to continue to go in that direction. You know, there's just tons and tons of stuff out there to be talked about. We're going to select, you know, a handful of it, and we're going to do just like we did last week. So I thank you for your feedback. Keep it flowing. If you want to hear about something specific, please let me know. Contact me through Twitter at WinOBS or contact me through our contact form at the website at WindowsObserver.com. So there's always breaking news. As I get ready to sit down and record this show, I always take a quick peek through Twitter and see what's getting talked about and things like that. And right before I settled in to do the show, there was a post from Paul Thurrott from the Windows Super site that there is a new firmware out for Nokia Lumia 920s, 820s, and 620s. My understanding from reading a couple sites, these may be AT&T-related updates. But specifically, it's the 920 one for sure. There was a 1308 release about 10 days ago that caused some issues, and Nokia opted to pull it and not farm it out anymore. I got it as soon as I heard about it last week, and apparently it introduced some connectivity issues. And I wasn't aware of any major connectivity issues over the last week or so. But the new update, which is firmware 1314, is now out there. Very quick and easy to access. Turn on your Wi-Fi on your phone or plug it to your computer. It'll be a pretty quick process. I think I was done in less than 15 minutes with the entire update. I have seen some reports on Twitter of people getting locked into kind of a cycle where the gears don't go away. The update process doesn't never seem to end. And I have shared a retweet from my buddy McCakins online overseas on how to hard reset the phone to get out of that loop if you're stuck in it. So please check that out. So if you're on a Lumia 920, 820, or a 620, check your firmware update. You may have an update sitting there waiting for you. The next story I want to cover is something that also just broke in the last hour. So not that it's new news, but it is the results of some news. And last week I talked to you a little bit on episode 85 about Digg and their goal to build a Google Reader replacement. It was one of the stories I'd written about on WindowsObserver.com. Well, they did that survey, apparently went out to about 17,000 people, and according to a blog post that went up just before lunch today, over 8,000 people responded to that, 50% response rate, at least a 50% response rate, which is just amazing, because, you know, I've done lots of surveys, and you're always hoping for great results like that, but 50% really gives you a very good snapshot and picture of what people are looking for in response to your questions. So it was an interesting poll. I shared with you in a blog post last week the kind of focus of the poll. But this is the results. This is where they say they stand now with what people talked about. So just to run over a few of the things, one of the questions they asked, users read a lot and a lot of the time. So the first question was, how many feeds do you subscribe to? And there's just a very small amount of people acknowledged 1 to 10. There was probably about 24-25% at the 11 to 50 feed mark. The similar type numbers at 51 to 100, about 21% over 100 through 250, and then actually about 18% over 250 plus feeds are read. So a lot of people reading a lot of feeds on Google Reader or whatever tool they use. When the question was asked, how often do you check your feeds? 80% of the people responded with the fact that they check it many times a day. The close runner-up was about 7% at once a day, and then it looks like 2% for more than once a week. So people check feeds a lot. So the system's obviously got to be robust in that sense. The question was asked, what do you use Google Reader for? Is it for work, is it for play, or is it for both? Well, the work response was looks like about 2.5-3%. Play was closer to 20%, but both was over 75% of the respondents said they use it for both. So lots of people use Google Reader both for leisure and for work-related tracking. What other desktop RSS apps and services do you use? The top one, over 40%, the answer was none. So I'm not quite sure what that means. Maybe it means they don't use any apps to read RSS, although I'm not quite sure how that works. Feedly came in second at about 38-39%. Feedly is an add-on or an extension for Chrome that lets you read. That's the only way to do it. There are no there. The mobile app connectivity is not there, at least on the Windows side. The next one was Reader for Mac at around 15-16%. The old Reader in about the same ballpark. And then Other was the fifth on the list. And then NewsBlur, NetVibes, and Prismatic all kind of 2.5-3% and down. Mobile apps, Google Reader for Android was the top response at about 30% plus. Feedly, Flipboard, Reader, none, and other, all kind of in that 18 to 21% range. And then way down on the list, Pulse, Zeit, and Feedler. This is an interesting one. They asked about shortcuts and search in Google Reader. Well, it's about a 33% split on whether people use shortcuts or not. It said all you got always, sometimes, and never. And again, they're basically, they look pretty close to being like split evenly thirds all across the board. Although they are reporting 67. So they're tying two numbers together. They're saying 67 reported that they use keyboard shortcuts at least some of the time. So they've combined the sometimes and the always into determining nearly 70% of people use keyboard shortcuts at one point or another. The search piece, now this is what I find to be interesting because what they say in the blog post is they're probably going to hold off on introducing search into whatever service Dig brings about for reading RSS feeds because of this result. And what it says is 25% report never using search and just over half said they have sometimes. So because search can be such a huge investment in terms of development time and infrastructure costs, they probably are going to hold that off for a while. So it's an interesting twist there. But again, they got some pretty good stats. They got very good response rates. I'm really blown away by having over 8,000 responses to their survey because out of 17,000, you know, getting over half is pretty good. But it also goes to show the enthusiasm that's out there about this whole situation. So we are continuing to watch that. That's going to continue to be very, very interesting. Last week, around April 8th or so, the story broke that we were 1 year out from the end of Windows XP support. The current Service Pack version for Windows XP is Service Pack 3. So if you, in order to get proper security updates and support in that nature, you have to have Service Pack 3 installed. You should have Service Pack 3 installed because that contains a conglomeration of fixes that go backwards to the beginning of Windows XP. So you should be running that. But we're less than a year away from official support dying. And what does that mean? In Microsoft's life cycle, and by the way, Windows XP got a couple extra years of life on this life cycle support thing. Normally it's 10 years for an OS. What it means is that there won't be any security updates. you're already in a window where there's no new features being introduced. So you've been in that from the first 5 years, you get those kind of changes, and beyond that, you don't. But the biggest deal is the security updates. On April of 2014, Microsoft will stop producing and publishing any security-related updates as it applies to the Windows XP system. So there's still 40% of the world out there that gets online and accesses websites or using Windows XP. So it's still a lot of people on XP. I see it all the time when I go and work on a job or something like that, and I encourage people, I warn them, hey, there's only a year left of proper support here. You need to be thinking about it. For many folks, old XP machines are in the 8 to 10 year range, 8 to 12 year range, and they really have to be thinking about some new hardware to at least run Windows 7. Most people don't even want to think about Vista, and I can't blame them. 7's a good system. Windows 8 can work as well. So it's coming. There is no denying that it's coming. Don't get caught up in it. If you're running Windows XP somewhere, you need to take a hard look at how you're going to upgrade and replace that system, because the last thing you want is to not have proper security updates for your OS, right? This past Tuesday was Patch Tuesday, talking about security updates. So there were 9 bulletins that had updates related to it, and those all got rolled out. If you're on automatic updates, they should have been installed Tuesday night, overnight. If you're not, you probably need to go hit Windows Update and download the updates. If you're on a Surface RT or Surface Pro, amongst the security updates was another firmware update for both systems. This one was supposed to continue to try to address the connectivity issues, Wi-Fi specific connectivity issues, that show a connection is limited availability or limited connectivity. I know I've seen a lot of people go through every one of those updates each month, and they continue to have connectivity problems with Wi-Fi. So hopefully we're getting real close, or this one fixed those issues. I haven't seen anything from those folks I follow on that in the last few days. But those firmware updates aren't introducing any crazy new features or anything like that. That's mainly hardware. Firmware is always related to your hardware. And then all the security updates are fixing security issues that are that have been identified. So you want to make sure you've updated your systems for that. Now for Surface, what's great about Surface RT and Pro, those firmware updates are introduced via Windows Update. So when you go to check Windows Update, it will tell you there's a firmware update. And it installs things in the right order to get your system up to date. So you need to go check that out. A story from LiveSide broke this week, and it was on several of the big tech websites, but it looks like Microsoft accounts is going to get two-factor authentication. Now, what two-factor authentication is just like kind of what it sounds. There are two steps in identifying yourself before you are granted access to an account. And again, this is a security feature that is intended to mean that if only one element of your identity is compromised in it, like a password, you got to have that second factor in order to be able to unlock the account or to gain full access. So as long as both of them don't get compromised at the same time, you're okay. So, this extra layer of protection on your account, it means that what happens is you'll sign in with your password, for instance. Then you'll need to enter an additional security code that we provide only to you. Now, that security code, from what it looks like with the Microsoft account, is going to come via your cell phone. And I think I've encouraged people before on this podcast, when you're setting up your Microsoft account, I can't tell you enough how many people on Xbox Live don't remember passwords, don't have access to the original email anymore, and they end up having to shut off an account. They may have collected a lot of downloadable content, a lot of gamer score, a lot of purchases, and because they can't authenticate into the account, it's history. It's gone, and Microsoft's not going to grant you access just because you say it's yours. I mean, they are in a business to protect the information of the user. So this two-factor authentication, having your cell phone number connected to your account is critical because it gives Microsoft an avenue to send you that info. Now, they probably also could help out with maybe a contact via email, or if you're on one of your what are called your trusted PCs, which means you've accessed and set up your system from there, that's considered, you won't have to do two-factor authentication. Two-factor authentication mainly applies to any device or apps that is in addition when you're logging into that Microsoft account from any device or apps, with the exception of, of devices added to your trusted PC list. In addition to your password, like I said, you'll be prompted to enter that security code, which gets randomly generated by an authenticator. So this is an important security step. I think it's, you know, Microsoft has improved security a lot around the accounts, but you have to be careful and savvy, and the more steps that we have to use a double authentication, the better it is. Now, the other element of this you got to keep in mind is that software programs, mail apps, Outlook, you know, for your Microsoft Office, they have to support these things because those systems want to be able to double authenticate as well. So there is, there may be some lag when something's updated and the functionality of that. Again, if I'm on my trusted PC or my trusted Surface RT, that's not an issue because I'm on a trusted machine and it knows I am. This is mainly for when you are on other devices that aren't your normal means of accessing your accounts, i.e. some hacker or scammer or spammer's computer somewhere in the world that's not you and isn't identified as you, okay? So that's a good steps to see that we're getting closer to having that kind of security on our Microsoft accounts. I found a really neat site this morning. I'd never heard of App Annie's blog ever anywhere, and I probably wouldn't have because it mainly tracked the app stores for iOS and Android. Well, they have added this morning app store data from the Windows Store, because that's information is public. In fact, there's several apps in the Windows Store that you can use to access public store data. The same thing applies to the Windows Phone. But they have now created a page, and again, you'll have a link on the show page for this, on the show links, but they talk about the top programs, and they go to the top 1,000, and they go top 1,000 free, paid, and new apps. And they break it down by x86, they break it down by x64, and break it down by ARM. It can be broken down by countries, categories. And just to give you an idea, the number one paid app in the Windows Store as of this morning was Bejeweled Live by PopCap. The top free app, Xbox Smart Glass from Microsoft. And the top new app is apps comic called Dragon Ball. So as you can see, this thing is will feature all those apps that are out there in the store. It's another great tool for you as an end user to look for apps that might be popular that go beyond what the Windows Store shows you. Right now, Windows Store only shows 100 apps in any category, top free, top paid, or top new. They only go up to 100. This will give you 900 more entries. And it, again, it just exposes information to you to maybe help you find an app that you're interested in or that you'd like to try out that you might not otherwise identify. Mary Jo Foley wrote more about Windows Blue this week. There's been a lot of discussion about Windows Blue, and this week specifically about Windows Blue for Windows, normal desktop operating system, and Windows Blue, i.e. the phone update and how close they are or aren't. But I wanted to pull up this story from Mary Jo because she makes a great comparison to what Windows Blue is. And the way she wrote it, you know, Windows Blue, which is referring to Windows 8.1 and Windows RT 8.1, are to Windows 8 the way Mountain Lion and what she said the other cat releases are to Apple's OS 10. About every year, Apple releases an update named after some type of a cat to the OS 10 operating system. Well, that's what she sees as she understands it. That's what Windows Blue is going to be. Windows Blue is going to be an update to the OS that is kind of on that level. So it is a new OS update. It has new features, it has fixes, it contains all kinds of things that will put it beyond the normal service pack category. Service packs tend to collect together updates and put them into one big package. Windows Blue is something we're continuing to watch. We're continuing to watch how much of this is coming together into one kind of across-the-board thing. It does sound like, based on what Mary Jo Foley wrote here, that based on some people she knows and talks to and has sources of, that a lot of the Microsoft software teams are going to have some type of a blue release. Some type, it might be Outlook.com, SkyDrive, Windows Phone, as we've already talked about, Server, Windows Services. So it sounds like it's a common theme across the board. Whether those updates will be included in the blue update or whether they'll come later like a lot of the different services updates do, that's a kind of a question to be watched for. But Windows Blue is coming. It's going to be part of our life. I think we're going to see a quicker cycle of Windows-related updates, and more so than on the pace of like the Patch Tuesday every month, but much faster than what we see in the Service Pack realm of things. All right. Xbox. News last week was that Microsoft sold their IP television property to called Media Room, and they sold that to... What they've done here is by selling this platform, which I don't know that they were really developing much. I mean, it's out there. They sold it to Ericsson, and apparently Media Room is on about 22 million set-top boxes in about 11 million households, according to LiveSide. But it's kind of with where Xbox has gone. Think about where Xbox has gone in the last, you know, year and a half since they released the media update a year and a half ago. It's really gone to become a source for video and television type viewing. So I think that's certainly where the next Xbox is going to go. And so in that sense, Microsoft has sold the Media Room IPTV to Ericsson, and Ericsson will take over the development and that technology. So I think Xbox is it all. Xbox is the media box, media entertainment, gaming box that Microsoft is going to focus on across the board. So getting exciting. There was a story this week that said it looked like May, late third or fourth week of May, might be when Microsoft updates and releases information about the next Xbox, whatever they're calling it. And that is just before E3, which is the Electronic Entertainment Expo out in Los Angeles in June. So I imagine they may not save everything for E3. PlayStation's already kind of came out with a little bit of a reveal. They showed off a handset, a controller, but we'll have to watch that because they're probably going to do some type of release, it looks like at least, before the big E3 show in June. And then, of course, I expect in June there to just be a massive, massive blitz of information about Xbox Next. Roku, my favorite media playing device. I mean, I plug this thing into my Wi-Fi, into my television, and I just can do a lot of easy things sitting in front of the television. I don't have my Xbox hooked up to my TV. Otherwise, that would be a means for me to do that. My Xbox is hooked to my work computer in the office, so I play my games on my monitor there. So we use the Roku in the living room to do all our media streaming. And Roku just passed 5 million players being sold. I think I mentioned a few weeks ago they released their Roku 3. And they are releasing the new interface for several of their devices sometime this month. So Roku continues to be, it seems at least, a very popular option. And they're inexpensive. $100 for the latest version. And then the slightly older technology, the last new version, is only $80. And it keeps going down from there. You can get an HD Roku for $50. And there's no fees. There's no other payments. You plug it into Wi-Fi, into your TV, set it up, and you have access to streaming content. And there are paid channels, but I've never had to pay for a channel. I use that to stream my Amazon Prime videos that we watch. Let's talk a little bit about social media. I got a few posts about social media. Two of them are the same. You might have heard in the last week about this guy named Adam Orth, who was the Microsoft Creative Director. Jumped on Twitter, talked about Always On, talked about why is that a big deal and everything like that, and had a bit of a rant. And then within a very short period of time, those tweets disappeared. I think they were either deleted or the account went private. There was an apology issued by Microsoft the next day that's not the view they take about customers and how we approach things. And when we have new stuff to tell you, we'll tell you. Apparently in the last 24 hours, Adam has chosen to either leave the job or he has been asked to leave the job one way or the other, but he's no longer with Microsoft according to the Game Informer website. So a rant did not pay off well for him, unfortunately. And then there's another one about a teen in the UK who got hired for this teen police commissioner job, a paying job apparently. However, not long after being on the job, they went back and looked at her social media history, specifically on Twitter, And she had a lot of questionable tweets in there about doing things about, like, breaking the law and cooking hash brownies and these other things that she talked about doing that wasn't necessarily what they would expect from this position that she was now in, that she'd been hired in. Well, that has resulted in her being fired or dismissed from that job. And it goes to show how smart and savvy, yeah, I'm not saying lie, but, you know, social media is a history. Social media is out there. Even if you publish it and delete it later, it's still out there available in search engines. So you can't get away from your past in that sense. It will always come back to get you at some point. So you have to be on your best behavior. You have to be putting your best foot forward. If you're going to be somebody who is going to do those types of things, then expectations have to be that it might not, you know, you just might not get the opportunities that you're looking for because of those things. I mean, we've been talking years about how social media is playing a bigger and bigger role in people getting hired for work and jobs, and employers are looking at social media and they're watching social media, and there's lots of legalities about that and things of that nature, but it is public domain. So that means it's public information that is available without any kind of a warrant or search or anything like that, and employers can look up that kind of stuff. So you have to be smart and savvy. It's unfortunate the two of them and their conduct on social media cost them what they were doing at the time. One last link about social media, and this is from All Twitter from Media Bistro. It's an infographic, and it says it actually is called Anti-Social Networks, and 88% of people answered in a survey think that others are less polite when using social media. And what's interesting is, think back, those of you that were around when email first came out, and how easy it was to misinterpret, it still is, how easy it is to misinterpret an email because you can't convey facial expressions or sarcasm or sincerity or anything like that in an email. I mean, about the only thing you can convey in an email is capitals or yelling. And if you put a smiley face, that's supposed to be tongue-in-cheek, I guess. But there's just a lot of risk for interpretation. Well, that's what this survey kind of identifies, is that people tend to be less polite. This is based on a survey that 88% of people think others are less polite when they're using social media. So, and it does. It takes away some barriers. It's back into that conduct and behavior thing. How would you approach somebody in person as opposed to offline or online? I'm sorry. And bring that to bear in your social media interactions. I mean, I've seen some things on Twitter, I'm sure all of us have, that really make you go wonder, you know, what's going on, and would they normally talk about somebody like that or treat somebody like that? So you have to be, again, be yourself. I'm saying to be yourself, but if that's who you are, then the consequences are what they are, okay? So you have to be smart when you're doing those kind of things. Channel 9, great resource of information for developers and end users. Channel 9 tends to focus towards the developer side, but they have a lot of great shows about apps on Windows, apps on Windows Phone, and so they're not just focused towards the developers, but they've got a tremendous amount of information nonetheless. And they have finally dropped a Windows Store app, and you can find that in a Windows Store, and it gives you immediate access to all the videos and all the content that's available on Channel 9. So nice option there for getting up with that, keeping up with that, and seeing the new stuff. They're having the Microsoft Management Summit this week out in Las Vegas, and there's already content from that available on the Channel 9 app on Windows 8. So I highly recommend that if you are into looking for that kind of information and you want to keep up with it, go download that app from the Windows Store. Another great resource that I pulled off of one of the MSDN blogs is an extensive resource of free Windows Phone 8 developer resources. And this is from talks on how to use the development software, best practices, hints and tips for how to put together an app and how to best address different kinds of user experience and content and data access. It is truly an extensive list of stuff that if you're a developer, this will help you become a better developer, help you learn more about the technology that Microsoft is using to help, you know, that part of their job is to help you develop and help you gain your skills as a Microsoft-based developer, and that's what this is just full of. It's full of those kind of resources. Also, just an interesting aside here to point out a blog post from Hal Berenson. Now, Hal Berenson is a former Microsoftie. I pulled up the wrong one. I don't want that one yet. And he wrote a story called Touch Hate. And it's a couple days old, but he writes about the fact that there's a lot, what he labels as a lot of hate for touch out there. And that, you know, he watches the discussions. He keeps an eye on these things. And he knows how these shifts are happening. He knows the interface has changed for Windows 8. But he gives a great summary of kind of how you approach those things, how you interact with those things, technology that is coming to give you options in order to better have a better touch interface experience, or vice versa, a mouse keyboard. He mentions the Logitech T650, which is a touch-based pad that you plug into a USB port. It's rechargeable, and it allows you to use a lot of the Windows 8 gestures. And he, in fact, you know, says they got that about right. But there is a lot to be said for the touch interface and how touch is used and how we can also use a mouse and a keyboard. He also talks about discoverability. Go read the comments on this post. The comments back and forth on this post are terrific because it really brings out different perspectives on the whole touch interface, mouse and keyboard interface, where Windows 8 is and isn't. And it really allows you to appreciate the different manner in which so many of us access information online. And you can't get away from it. And things have to be discoverable. You have to be able to figure out how to do certain things. And Windows 8 does have some level of challenge in that discoverability piece because there's lots of different ways to interact with it. And so time and space will give you that. Time and experience will expose you to those functions, and you'll get better and better. I easily move now between touch and mouse and keyboard on my desktop and touch on my Surface. And even an old Windows 7 system I run to do the podcasting on. So there's lots of variation out there, and it's just, you know, paying attention to it and learning from it. And a guy like Hal is a great resource. His website is called Hal's Imperfect Vision with IM in parentheses. And it's a great place to learn. I follow his stuff all the time, and he constantly has terrific information. So go check out that Touch Hate post he's got, but also look at some of the other stuff he's been working on as well. Okay, it's time now to tackle the news of the week, really, and that's this whole PC shipment stuff. IDC published yesterday, I think it was, the 10th of April, they reported that there was a significant, almost 14% decline year-to-year on the same quarter for PC shipments worldwide. And it goes into details about which different companies are doing well and, you know, the change. But here's the heartburn I have, and I'm going to give you the link to a couple other stories that talk about this report. But the heartburn I have with this, and I wrote about this back in January, late January, that our typical definition of PC doesn't work anymore. I have a Surface RT in front of me that is more tablet than it is PC, but it's... Look at the Surface Pro, which is a full-blown PC, x86 compatible, and it does everything your desktop PC can do. We have to change the definition of what a PC is. A PC is no longer a beige box. It's no longer a black box that you bought from the computer store and put together your own computer. It's not the Dell or the Gateway or the other systems that you buy in the store or online or anywhere. PCs are changing. Think about the new form factors that we've seen this year since CES out in Las Vegas, and how Windows 8 PCs are changing, and how they're detachable screens and, you know, keyboard docks and things of that nature. And the specific thing in this story that I want to go to and I want to point out is a note on how IDC counted computers. And it's their... And here's what they say. PCs include desktops, portables, mini notebooks, and workstations, and do not include handhelds, x86 servers, and tablets, which is a slate form factor device regardless of OS or chip type, such as an iPad, Android, or Windows-based tablet. So right there, they basically eliminate any of these new form factor of Windows 8 computers that have detachable PCs and things of that nature from being counted as a PC. And that's just not the truth. That's just not reality these days. And I had a terrific Twitter discussion yesterday afternoon with several people about this. And the fact that we do, the industry, I say we, the industry has to go out there and redefine what it means, a PC, what it means, a smartphone. Because smartphones, what is it? That latest one this week is 6.3-inch they're talking about releasing. I mean, smartphones are getting bigger and bigger. Tablets and other form factor devices are getting smaller. The industry needs to sit down and redefine what is a PC, what's a computing device, what's a smartphone, what's a tablet, how are we going to count these things? Because right now, they're comparing data from a year earlier and this year with Windows, and they're blaming Windows 8. This is the biggest part of this. They're blaming Windows 8 for the decline. Now, I asked the question, if Windows 7 was still the OS of a function, would there be a decline? The general consensus back on Twitter was yes. Now, Windows 8 released in October. Decline happened this latest quarter. They're pointing at Windows 8 for being at fault, but they're not counting all the devices that have Windows 8 on them. So how can they say Windows 8 it's a fault when they're choosing not to count x86 tablets that don't fit the typical, quote-unquote, traditional PC definition of a box or a laptop or a netbook or anything like that? That has to be fixed. Until that gets fixed, these numbers that are being spurted about PC declines, it becomes mute. It becomes useless because you're not counting everything that is computing as a PC does or like a PC can. So until that changes, you know what? And I get that this impacts things. Guess what happened this morning? PC stocks like Microsoft and other manufacturers down on this news. You've had a couple of stock advisors that have moved Microsoft stocks from, I think, neutral to not buy, one from buy to neutral. So it is impacting the industry tremendously, but yet it is not accurately defining what is a PC to count that sale. So until they start counting those handhelds and tablets, it's useless. It just really is useless. It's frustrating because, you know, I am who I am. I'm a computer user. I'm a PC user. I'm not a Mac user. We've never called a Mac a PC, although it functions like a PC. We've never called it that, but is it time to change that? Is it time to call a tablet that might have a detachable keyboard that runs Windows software, a PC, or a computing device? Whatever term you're going to use, computing industry, technical industry, you need to get together and fix it. All right, enough. I'm off the soapbox. All right, the last thing I'll point out from the news stack before I talk a little bit about what we've been talking about at WindowsObserver.com this past week is I want to point you towards ZDNet. They have these great debates where they take two different authors from the website with two varying views of a subject, and they give their it's kind of like a debate. Well, it's called the Great Debate. It's a debate about, and one person is supporting one side, and one person is obviously supporting the other side, and they give their write-ups to start it. It's voting is opened, and so you're able to vote, and then they have a follow-up to that. So there's opening statements. There's rebuttals, and then there's closing statements. And this one is, the title is, Windows 8, Can This OS Be Saved? And this puts Ed Bott, who is a very well-known ZDNet author and a pro Windows guy, very savvy on the Windows ecosystem, against Stephen J. Von Nichols. Now, Stephen J. Von Nichols is also very well-known for his opinion of Windows, and it's his opinion, and I respect that. I don't agree with it, but I respect that he has his own opinion. Well, they are the ones that have put the counter arguments to each other. Ed said, yes, it can be saved. And Stephen J. Von Nichols has said, no, it can't be. This is an autopsy. Windows 8 is dead on arrival. And they go into great detail on their three different inputs on that. Here's the interesting part. Today, I think in the last hour or so, this voting has closed. And the final verdict has been delivered. Now, I'm going to point out the voting. 54% favored Ed's viewpoint, i.e., yes, it can be saved, and 46% supported Stephen J. Von Nichols, which was no, it can't be saved. So it's split. I mean, I think we could all agree that Windows 8 has kind of created that type of an environment. A lot of people are split one way or the other on this, so it was very close to that. Now, I'm going to read Larry Dignan from ZDNet is the guy who did the what's called the final kind of tally. And I'm just going to share that with you. The debate was arguably one of the most entertaining. It captured the blood sport, which is the Windows 8 debate. Ed had a strong argument with many nuances to note. Stephen J. Vaughn Nichols had two tricks, the UI stinks and the tablets and smartphones trump PCs. Personally, Larry Dignan thinks that Microsoft is going to need Windows 9 to put Windows 8 behind it, which is a lot of people. Again, I think it's split down the middle, but he has to put aside the crowd's comment, the vote, and my personal bias to judge the arguments on the page. On the front, I have to give the argument to Ed, but it's found Stephen's Metro happy rebuttal blistering and comical at times. Hats off to both for a good show. Ed gets the win. So go read the comments. There are 623 comments on this story. If you can sit through and suffer through some of those, you can really get a good perspective of kind of the viewpoint of a lot of people following that. That's a lot of comments on one story. So it's split. It really is kind of a right down the middle. People either it's a love or hate, I think. I don't think there's much middle ground with Windows 8. And that's been my typical experience with most people. If they say they hate it, they hate it. There's not any parts that they tend to like. It really is split 50-50. So maybe that pure issue is what we are going to need the next version of Windows to kind of back to move beyond it. But when I want to go back to this whole IDC and computer sales thing, that PC sales is talking hardware. I had this discussion with Simon Bison, who wrote a terrific article on ZDNet. He's a ZDNet contributor from the UK. He wrote a great article about how it's more than just the boxes. And we need to know what sales have been, upgrade sales. People don't buy new boxes these days as much as they used to. He calls it the good enough computing time frame era. And that means my hardware is good enough to do what I needed to do. Upgrades don't buy you that much more performance. So a lot of people may have installed upgrades to Windows 8, and it'd be very interesting to hear sales figures at this point to say exactly how many upgrades have been sold, how many OEM licenses, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So go check that out. That's from Ken Hess as well, who gives a great input about Windows 8 that he thinks it doesn't need to be saved. And he talks a lot about that same kind of hardware attitude that Simon Bison does. All right. Now, let's talk a little bit about the last week in WindowsObserver.com. Most of the stuff I've seemed to have mentioned already. One, Patch Tuesday. I did do a post that kind of pulled all the links and resources together. It's been a long time since I put links and resources in one phrase. If you're interested, this August will be 18 years that WindowsObserver.com has been around in some shape or form. And my first name for this website when I built it in 1995 on GeoCities was another Windows 95 links and resources page. So it's kind of weird to write those words again after so many years. Anyway, had a developer get a hold of me about the Weave newsreader. It's coming to Windows 8. These are from the guys that built Tweetro Plus and MetroTube. From Lazy Worm Applications. You might remember them for Tweetro Plus when basically Twitter shut them down hard and did not give them more user tokens. And that created a big uproar, and that's just the beginning of that whole process of shutting down third-party apps. Nokia expanded their music offerings. They actually released their Nokia Music app to Windows 8, and it gives you the capability to do music playback, subscribe to the $4 a month Nokia Music subscription. But it will play your local music. It doesn't let you do a lot. You can queue things up, but you can't change any. You can't create playlist. You cannot edit the metadata on your songs, which is what a lot of people want to do in Xbox Music, but still can't. A lot of frustration from Zune users who used to have that capability. App Spotlights. This one I wrote about this morning, in fact. It's a great app that allows developers to go find out when their apps are featured in the Windows Phone Store. You know, Microsoft features about 2,400 apps a day across 120 markets at some point or another in different categories, and there's not an easy way for a developer to find out their app has been featured. So this allows that to happen. It allows them to put their app name in there, and it will tell them how much it's been featured, when it's being featured, and things like that. For a consumer, for you and me, it's a great app to find popular stuff because Microsoft does not feature an app unless it meets certain criteria, which is popularity, downloads, reviews, things of that nature. So it's a great means for us to discover apps. So I highly recommend you install App Spotlight on your Windows Phone to do just that. And the last item I have is something I wrote up last night. Windows Phone users. The the desire to have anything Instagram on Windows Phone is becoming completely unreal. The moment something comes out for Windows Phone that remotely gives access or a means to publish to Instagram, people just flock to it. And this latest app is out, and it had some problems. It's not a direct access to Instagram. It's called Instagraph. And what they're doing is they're providing a middle point. They're providing a server that you give them your account data in the app, upload a picture, it goes to that server, and it sits there on the server and gets queued up to go to your account on Instagram. And then it goes. Their first day, they had some problems. Apparently, there was a placeholder picture that was on multiple people's accounts. Their own pictures didn't make it there. I'd initially believed that it was other people's pictures, but maybe that's not the case from what I'm hearing. But people are willing to, okay, now your Instagram account information is sitting on that server. So when you delete and uninstall this app, does it uninstall your data from that server that's sitting in the cloud somewhere feeding pictures to Instagram? I mean, that's a concern. That's even if they are protecting it to the utmost of their ability, is your information there once you choose not to use their app anymore? So user data, very concerned about user data. It's apparently very slow in the process, although I read earlier today that they have fixed some things. It's taken like 5 minutes for your picture to go from Instagraph to the server to Instagram. So it's working better, but they're only allowing you to upload 3 pictures a day. So it's very limited in what it can do. Now, the promise is, by the way, after you pay $2 for it with no trial, is that down the road, as we make money, we'll increase the server outputs, we'll increase the server capabilities, and this will become almost seamless. My big concern in all of this, one, I'm not a fan of no trials. I'm not paying straight out money. Even if it is only $2, I'm not paying out straight out money without a trial. I would have to have like a person I know so well who comes to me and says, this app is worth it, you should buy it. I might do it then, but I'm just not going to blindly pay out $2 when there's no formal refund process in place to recuperate my money. All right, so concern about the no trial, my concern about user data, my concern about they're using some kind of a loophole, which they say is legal. Okay, I'll believe them at face value, but what happens when Instagram decides to close that loophole or decides to make it against their term of service? Now you're out $2. Now you're out your means to post to Instagram. The only thing that is ultimately going to fix this entire Instagram thing on Windows Phone is for there to be an official app. Now, how that happens, I don't know. Maybe there's one in the works. Maybe it's happening already and we just don't know about it. But whatever happens, the only way this is going to get solved and get solved right is to get an official app for Instagram on the Windows Phone platform. So with that said, that's it. Episode 86 in the can. A pleasure to be with you once again. Lots of stuff going on in the tech world. The weather here in North America in the Northern Hemisphere is warming up. I've had to kick the AC on more than I thought about in the last 6 months. But whatever the bottom line is, it's important that you stay safe out there, that you pay attention, and that you make sure you keep all your things up to date. And don't click on that link if you don't think it's safe. Ask somebody and ask them what they think about that. So until next week, keep your computer up to date and stay safe on the net. Take care.